KXAM.
From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist here in Los Angeles. And we deal every week here with issues related to mental health, emotional, psychological, spiritual. I obviously then take a very holistic approach to the work that I do. So we cover it all here, and it is a live show. And if you are so inclined to call in tonight, our topic tonight is the importance of rituals and rites of passage, particularly in psychotherapy, but what role do they play in our lives in general? So if you're in the Phoenix area, where the show is heard on KXAM, the local number is 480-874-1311. That's 480-874-1311. And if you are listening anywhere else in the country via the internet, the toll-free line is 1-888-437-7660. 1-888-437-7660. So, rituals, rites of passage. I don't know why I picked this topic tonight. It just is what came to me. And I guess maybe it's the fact that both of my parents, last year my dad turned 80 and we had a big party for him in New York, and my mom's turning 80 this June, and my brothers and I are discussing what we're going to do about that. And I recently got an email from my cousins, and we're celebrating my aunt's 75th birthday, and they're throwing a party, and I guess maybe that's part of where this topic came from tonight. What we're talking about with these birthday celebrations is, in a sense, a ritual that's celebrating a rite of passage. Rite of passage being milestone birthdays like 75, 80, or for many of us, my nephew just celebrated his, although it's usually used for women, but sweet 16, because usually there are certain milestone birthdays for kids, and very often that's when they turn 13, actually officially become a teenager, maybe 16 when they're getting into high school and thought of a bit differently in terms of the midway point between child, teenager, into adulthood, very often 18 when they get other rights. They're able to drive in most states at that point. Some states allow them to drink at that point. So those are milestone birthdays that acknowledge a rite of passage. Very often it's 20 when you're no longer a teenager, or 21 where, again, certain other legal things in our society are given to us. So the birthday issues obviously are a rite of passage, and for some people it's a traumatic one. People have a rough time dealing with middle age, or the 40, or the 50, or some people have a difficult time realizing they've just turned 30. So these are all rites of passage birthdays. A rite of passage is a significant experience that transforms one's sense of self and place in the world. I'm going to read that again. A rite of passage, and this is a definition that a colleague of mine, Jim Walton, uses. Rite of passage, a significant experience that transforms one's sense of self and place in the world. Just like I said with the birthdays. Now, what is a ritual? A ritual is an event, And actually, I'm going to read the Encarta Dictionary. A ritual is an established formal behavior, an established and prescribed pattern of observation, for example, in a religion, like a religious ritual. Actions done formally and repeatedly, the performance of actions or procedures in a set, ordered, and ceremonial way. So ritual may be something that may actually come out of a book and read. It may be something that is symbolic. And there are a lot of rituals that may take place honoring a rite of passage. Now, we're talking here about the bigger picture of rites of passage and rituals. And I'm going to get into that more specifically. But I also want to talk and plant the seed that there are personal rituals that many of us use that we may not even be aware are rituals. And some of them are very healthy for us, some of them are not particularly healthy rituals. Now, we're talking tonight about rituals. We're not necessarily talking about ritualistic behavior as in an obsessive-compulsive disorder, because that's taking this beyond into much more clinical issues. I'm talking about rituals that acknowledge something that help us connect with a higher part of us. And rituals, in a sense, are tools for harmony and familiarity. Rituals may be a connection to spirit. A ritual may be a tool for transformation. And a ritual may be a way of honoring change or honoring that transformation. So, when we're talking about, let's get back to rituals for a minute. There is, in the Jewish religion, a rite of passage called the bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah for boys or girls. The ceremony itself is filled with ritual. Certain readings from the Torah, from the Bible, certain blessings, lighting of candles, all those are rituals within the service that is a rite of passage for that boy or girl at age 13. In Catholicism, it may be a confirmation. It may be their first Holy Communion. There are rituals that take place within that ceremony that acknowledges the rite of passage of that child, but the rituals themselves are what are done to honor, to help those kids and the, not just the kids, but the witnesses to the rite of passage connect to spirit on a deeper level. It's a way of honoring that change, the new way this child is seen in the community. Step towards adulthood, teaching them what their relationship with spirit is about and giving them an opportunity to demonstrate their own deeper connection with it and understanding of the transformation and the new step in their lives. So when we're dealing with rituals, we're looking at healthy rituals versus not healthy rituals. We tend to think in terms of religious rituals as part of healthy. There are family rituals, there are societal rituals, a company or a business may have certain rituals, and there are personal rituals that we all have. Now, the religious ones tend to be a bit more obvious. You know, maybe lighting of candles, it may be certain services or components of those services. It may be certain rituals like Orthodox Jews do every morning with the tefillin and every night. It may be the rituals that Muslims do in terms of the daily ritual of praying, bowing, and focusing towards the east and saying their prayers the same way, with the same prayers a number of times throughout the day. These are religious rituals. and a way of acknowledging, taking time out of their day to acknowledge a connection with spirit. It may be a Buddhist that does their chanting on a regular basis. These are all rituals. Okay? Think about what your family does that's ritualistic. For some people, there are very healthy family rituals. And that ritual may be certain things that happen around the holidays, certain ways of celebrating it, certain things that go on the tree and the family coming together to decorate a tree for Christmas, or the ritual of the Hanukkah menorah, and newer rituals in the African American community of Kwanzaa, that there are lighting of candles and wearing of certain clothing, and these are rituals also that are healthy and that help people become more conscious of a greater community that they're part of, while personally having a deeper connection to their own sense of spirit. So family rituals, and healthy may be also that they come together to eat dinner at the same time. There may be family rituals that include a family reunion once every year or once every 5 years or whatever. There may be the family ritual of the first barbecue of the summer. These are all, we may not see these events as rituals, but in a sense, there's something missing when we're not participating in them, or there's something missing when all of a sudden we move away, like going to college for the first time or leaving home, and you're not there for them. There's a sense of something's missing here. And I know that you'll feel something missing when we take this break, and we're going to be right back after this brief message. So stay tuned.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
Rituals and rites of passage and their importance in our lives and in our society. And I believe we have a caller. Janice, are you on there?
I am.
Hi, Janice. Where are you calling from?
I'm Mesa.
Well, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Well, I think I figured out why my sister is ill all the time.
Uh-huh.
We were brought up Christian, Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
She married a man who was Catholic, and she converted to that. And I said, how can you do that? She says, it's easy. I just don't believe half of it.
Okay.
I'm like, isn't that being a hypocrite? So no wonder she's ill all the time, because she's saying she believes something by saying she's Catholic, but she doesn't believe it.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of ritual with the Catholic Church.
Right.
A lot of it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
she doesn't go to church anymore. Neither do his husband, does her husband, or her kids, but they're all Catholic.
Right. Well, what you're talking...
She teaches, and she thinks she's, really teaches morals and all that, and she's a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm.
She's a loving person. But she gets so stressed out all the time. And I think it's part of her not realizing she's being a hypocrite. And I haven't confronted her about it yet, but I think I will.
Well, think for a minute about maybe it's not about hypocrisy. Maybe
not a bad hypocrisy?
No, that maybe it's not about hypocrisy. I'm going to give you a little bit more food for thought to consider here.
I don't really want to confront her and call her a hypocrite.
I get to
say,
maybe,
I want her to be well.
Okay, so maybe I can soften it here a little bit for you. You were raised Protestant, and like I was saying earlier, families have certain rituals, and the religion that we're raised in often is part of that ritual of coming together certain days of the week or as a family.
Oh, she lives in California, and I live in Arizona,
right, but growing up.
Occasionally for a reunion or
right.
A holiday, like my mother's birthday or something.
Right. But Janice, what I'm saying is that growing up, these things got implanted. And so when she converted to Catholicism...
Well, it was because her husband was, and his parents were very strict Catholics.
Right. But I understand that. What I'm suggesting, though, is that her conversion may have come from a very loving place. She loved her husband, and this
yes.
was an important aspect to her. And what she may have lost touch with is the reason she initially converted was because of love. And
yes.
and at the same time, it may not be hypocrisy, it may be guilt, because even though her adult mind and heart is saying, I did this because of love, the child part of her mind is saying, I have dishonored my family rituals. I've dishonored my family's
yeah.
commitment. And so she might not even be aware.
She doesn't even know it.
That's what I'm saying. She may not even be aware of it. And the other part of it is, you may be interpreting that she's off track. But she may be totally at peace with the spiritual and religious
situation. Says she's a Catholic, but she says, I says, how can you do that? And she mm-hmm. says, it's easy. I just don't believe half of it.
Right.
I only believe the part that I grew up with.
Well,
but
the,
if you
the
say
part
one
of,
thing,
yeah, the part yeah. of Protestantism that is part of Catholicism, you know, there's a saying in 12-step programs, take what you need and leave
That's
the rest.
I'm attending right now.
Okay.
I'm just outside the door. I
okay.
keep going.
Good.
Go to Central Christian Church.
And that may be how she's
yeah.
been. That may be how she's been able to be at peace with the conversion, because she's taking what she needs. She's leaving the rest. Her illness may be coming from a lot of other stresses. This may or may not be part of it, but there may be other things that are going
on. Her husband had back surgery, and you know what? He had it scheduled, and then he thought he would have lived a bad life, that he wasn't ready to die, so he had to cancel his surgery because
mm-hmm.
he went and saw a psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and then he was able to go on and have his surgery to relieve all the pain. So she has been under a lot of stress.
Yeah.
Hearing her husband, I mean, he's interviewed doctors. He's gone to probably hundreds of doctors
mm-hmm.
to determine what he's going to do with his back.
Right. Well,
and he still couldn't do it.
We're talking here about the possibility of some other rituals, and I know that sometimes illness becomes the ritual that people latch onto also, pain and illness.
Yeah.
Because it becomes a familiar thing, or because it's gotten them attention, or because...
That's why she's teaching, because she can't stand to be around her husband
right.
all day long.
You know, so...
He's into his pain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now he's okay now.
Right, good. You know, so the illness for some people, you know, may be part of that ritual pattern of behavior that helps them avoid dealing with other things, or because it gets them the attention that they want, or because it becomes so much a part of their identity that they don't know what to do to break that pattern and to start living without the pain and living without the illness. Now, what your brother-in-law did was very smart. He went somewhere to help have someone else help him.
Well, my sister suggested he see the psychiatrist.
Well, that was smart of her,
yeah.
too, that maybe help him understand what the subconscious reasons are for, you know, all the problems he's having and that his body is responding to, so that it may break that cycle of illness and pain if that's what's going on. So, you know...
Well, you know, I did teach 5 years in downtown Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
and I was ill a lot myself because I'm around kids a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I was in junior high, and that's what she's, you know, kids... People send their kids to school even when they're sick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't teach anymore.
Right.
I substitute teach, but I'm not under constant
mm-hmm.
stress of lesson plans.
Right.
And I know she's very thorough, that she would not be a bad teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she'll stay up all hours. Well, that's part of why she's sick, because she doesn't get enough sleep
mm-hmm.
because she's doing her lesson plans at home because you don't have enough time at school.
Right. Well, that's a problem a lot of teachers face, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Now, you said you're on your way into a 12-step meeting. Is that what you said?
I go to 3 of them right now. I'm helping start one, and I go to 2 other. I mean, this one and
for
another
what,
one. It's Christ-centered.
The 12-step meeting is because of an addiction for yourself that you've been dealing with? Or
depression from a divorce.
Okay.
But I'm better now.
Great.
I am probably stronger than I've ever been in my life now.
Excellent. And the program helped you do that.
Oh, definitely.
Great.
I did take some medicine, you know, from a psychiatrist.
Right.
Antidepressant. It put on a whole bunch of weight.
Mm-hmm.
I got constipated from it. Now I'm not taking any, and I feel 100% better.
Good.
But now I got to lose all this weight. So that's
okay.
not good for my health either.
That's right. Now, the point I was getting to, though, is that I was going to talk about later, but you've opened the door for me, is that even addicts have certain rituals that are unhealthy, which, you know, like for a drug addict, you know, needing to take things at a certain time or doing their drugs or the seeking their drugs in a certain way become part of the addictive ritual. But
I'm codependent.
Right.
That's why I
mm-hmm.
started here. I didn't know what codependency meant, but
sure.
now I do.
Mm-hmm.
I can see it all now, how
right.
badly codependent I was.
Well, even for codependents and addicts then that are in recovery, the meetings become part of their healing ritual. You know,
right.
Your sense of prayer becomes part of your healing ritual. And
yes.
so what we're looking at here is how do we go from the unhealthy rituals and actually create healthier rituals. And that's one of the problems.
I get more out of this than I have in all the years I've ever gone to just church.
Uh-huh.
Because this confronts the problems.
Right. There's a different level of truth and honesty that comes
yeah.
out. And, you know, prayer,
small
I think...
Small groups, right.
Right. Prayer, I think, works wonders. But to combine the spiritual stuff that prayer gives us along with the group interaction and the honesty that comes from the sharing in a group like a 12-step meeting or group therapy or anything like that, it really adds another component to the healing ritual that I'm talking about tonight. So,
yeah, I think the facilitator I have is, I mean, she has such a ministry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can call her day or night
right.
at work, at home. You know, if she can't help me, she'll find someone else that
right.
will.
Well, I appreciate you calling tonight, Janet, and your input, Janice, and your input on this, and I won't
well,
hold you
I won't hear
meeting.
What you say after this because I'm going to go into my meeting.
Well, thank you for calling and taking
you.
The time before your meeting, and okay. glad you were listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
A short break here and come back and keep talking about this and a little bit more about some of the material Janice raised here, so stay tuned. Thank you. Welcome back to Tell the Truth to Esther. This is Stuart Altschul, and tonight's topic is rituals, their importance on us psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually. And I want to thank Janice for taking the time to call in before going into her 12-step meeting. And again, she brought up some important issues when it comes to addictions and codependency issues, because even in our relationships, I believe that there are rituals in how we struggle with one another, how we fight with one another, how we communicate with one another, how we have a lack of communication with one another. If you take it all down to some kind of learned ritualistic behavior, maybe from our parents, you know, the ritual of the silent treatment of not talking because you're angry, the ritual of escalating into a lot of yelling or, you know, the repetitive thing of it blowing up into something violent and then the makeup, all becomes, if you want to look at it this way, part of a ritualistic behavior that is unhealthy and destructive in the context of one personally as well as within the family or relationship situation. So, for an addict, you know, I've often talked about in the past that they're, you know, even someone who smokes pot on a regular basis may have certain ritual that they have, and if you're a pot smoker, you might want to take a look at this, and you can apply it to other drugs and even alcohol use, that there is a ritual involved with where you keep the pot, how you roll the joint or stuff the pipe, how you get ready. I had one friend who always used to roll one joint, stick it behind his ear like you would a pencil or something, and then roll the second one. And, you know, it would always be at a certain table and taken out of the box in a certain way, and it's almost as if the anticipation of beginning to start using the chemical was as much a part of the ritual as using the chemical. And very often for addicts, dealing with the ritualistic behavior separate from the chemical use is just as important in terms of recovery. Even for an alcoholic, the ritualistic behavior of how they take the drink or where they seek the drink or what rituals they have in terms of keeping it a secret and all of those dysfunctional type of things are all part of ritualistic behavior. And that's why 12-step meetings, group therapy, and other things, you know, regular therapy, are so important in the healing process for any addict, whether it's sex addiction or food or drugs, alcohol, whatever. Helping the individual learn some new rituals that actually help with the healing, like I said to Janice. Her going to meetings on a regular basis. Journaling becomes a ritual for some people, whether they're in 12-step programs or not, where every day or every evening, you know, that they take a certain amount of time to do some journaling. The ritual of placing phone calls to their support system, to their sponsor, or whoever else they're meeting, is all, if you want to look at it this way, part of healthier, newer rituals that actually feel better. Because the one thing most addicts are scared of is once they stop using the behavior or the substance, they're stuck with what they're feeling, and they're stuck with things that they've been avoiding looking at for a long time. And it's important that they are consciously aware that there are things that can substitute for the drug use, the addictive or compulsive behaviors, that are healthier. And if they do it in a conscious way, then what they're doing is reprogramming their lives and their behaviors with healthier, more fulfilling rituals. Okay? Think in terms of even your own personal life. There's rituals we perform every day. Think about when you first get up in the morning. You usually go into the bathroom and do things in a certain order. And that doesn't mean it's obsessive compulsive. It's stuff that became, it's like centering you to get on with your day, because these are familiar things. If you ever have a morning where maybe you're on the road or something like that, and if something feels a little bit off because you don't have the toothbrush in the same place and things aren't being done in order, or if you go camping or whatever, that there's a difference. And you may feel something different throughout the day because of not having that usual morning ritual. Now, rites of passage. Let's go back to them for a minute. Rites of passage, as I defined earlier, is a significant experience that transforms one's sense of self and defined relationship to one's world. Now, I talked earlier about, you know, major birthday rites of passage. There are other things that take place, like losing one's first tooth as a child, starting school, you know, and if you've ever had a child, or if you remember your own first day at school, you know, maybe mom or dad took you to the bus, or maybe actually took you to the school, and how did you feel? A graduation is a rite of passage. And getting your driver's license is a rite of passage. A first major purchase, whether it's a car or a house or something, where you know all of a sudden you've spent a larger amount of money than you've been used to doing. Maybe you got credit for the first time. There was a feeling of maybe a little bit of fear, but a little bit of excitement, a little bit of pride, that you were able to do this and that your life is now at a point where you could do this. Experiencing puberty is a rite of passage, the beginning of wet dreams, or a woman's first period, is, again, a rite of passage, something that's transforming the way you look at yourself in relationship to the world, as well as your sense of self. The first time you get a job. Retirement is a rite of passage. Having children. All transforms one's sense of self and relationship to the world. Obviously, death is another one. Birth is another one. Marriage is another one. And think in terms of all the debates going on between allowing marriage for, you know, gay and lesbian people who also have a sense of commitment in their own relationships, and that rite of passage for many, you know, is clearly an important aspect of who we are as human beings, the statement we're able to make in terms of our sense of commitment and love to another human being, and our desire to do it publicly and to share it with our loved ones, the same way a heterosexual couple is able to do that. Now, in addition to being a therapist, I'm an ordained minister in the Universal Life Church, and I achieve that in order to perform wedding ceremonies and commitment ceremonies, because this, you know, couple, Karen and Todd, had asked me to do their wedding about 7 years ago, I think, and I wanted to be able to do it. I had been officiating enough memorial services over many years because of the, you know, friends and colleagues that I've had with AIDS, and because of the way they saw me, you know, they wanted me to do these memorials, and I did so many of them. It was such a blessing also now to be officiating at commitment ceremonies or wedding ceremonies, to be able to do it legally for those that could, and to be able to at least bring an essence of spirit and a greater consciousness to the reason why the commitment ceremonies were being done for the gay and lesbian couples that I've done this for. And it's humbling. It's a very powerful experience. In fact, after one of the ceremonies I did for this gay couple, Dan and Jim, the stepfather of one of them came up to me in tears, and he said he never understood the importance of this for two gay men until he saw the power and beauty of the ceremony that he just witnessed. He said it was more powerful and more touching and brought something deeper into his heart than any heterosexual wedding he'd ever been to. And understand that, again, having a public statement is a very important thing for everyone. If you're heterosexual and you're listening, know how important that feels to you, that when you fall in love, or if you've fallen in love, has someday have a ceremony that states to the world that this is who you are in relationship to another human being. This is what your heart calls you to do. This is what the spirit within you calls you to do. And if you've already done that, if you already had that ceremony, even if the relationship is not lasting or hasn't lasted, think of what that day was about for you and the importance and power of that moment, that transforming power of that commitment publicly. And what would make you think that a gay or lesbian couple would not get the same feeling from it in terms of their relationship and have the same desire to be able to have that option to do it? So, again, rites of passage in any relationship, whether it's, you know, gay, lesbian, or heterosexual, is an important aspect in people's lives. Now, I know some of you out there listening may already be debating this with me. Maybe some of you who'd never thought about it in those terms might be saying to yourself, well, that makes sense. It's two human beings who love each other, even if I don't understand that kind of love, might want to be able to publicly make this statement to, in the presence of their loved ones, or maybe even privately between the two of them. So marriage, commitment ceremonies, these are rites of passage. This is a way of being seen different, defined differently in relationship to the world around you, as well as your own sense of self, or your sense of self in the context of a relationship. So, think for a moment about what rites of passage you've experienced and how they were acknowledged or not acknowledged. You know, I know some people who have been scarred because as a kid, mom or dad never really threw a birthday party for them. And while they were invited constantly to other kids' birthday parties, believe it or not, their parents just did not make a big deal out of their birthdays each year. Those rituals, especially for children, enhance one's self-esteem, make them feel special and important, celebrating the fact that one was actually born is an incredibly important thing, whether it's as an adult, but especially as children. Think whether you're doing this to your children. How do you celebrate? What rituals do you have that let these kids in your life know that they're loved, that they're special, that they're worthwhile, that you're glad that they're here? We're going to take a break here, and I'm going to leave you to think about that for a little while before we come back. for our final segment. Okay, so stay tuned to Tell the Truth Faster. Thank you. Welcome back to Tell the Truth, Pastor. This is Stuart Altshuler. And tonight we've been talking about the importance of rituals and rites of passage and how their influence, how they influence us psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually. And as a therapist, I think it's really important to help people understand this concept and to bring an awareness to these rituals and to rites of passage. In fact, there are some times when I've had a client who maybe hasn't grieved the loss of, you know, a loved one or the loss of a job or their life as they used to be, and this was true especially over the years as I worked so much with people with HIV and AIDS, that there's a whole shift in one's consciousness about their relationship to the world when they have an illness, whether they are acutely ill or HIV positive, whether it's cancer, anything else that goes on, when someone is told that there is a medical diagnosis that is potentially life-threatening or life-limiting, potentially, it changes their whole sense of self and their sense of relationship to the world around them. And there are times when I've suggested to a client that they actually create a ritual, whether it's a memorial service that they do on their own, whether it's some kind of ritual where they're writing a letter to their life as they knew it and actually burning it and doing some ritual with fire. Fire is often a really good healing component in any ritual. And if you notice, every one of the world's religions uses fire through lighting candles, or the Native Americans and doing their ceremonies around a fire, or sweat lodges, burning of tobacco and other things like that. Fire is an important part of the symbolism and the healing process of rituals for all the world's religions and spiritual focuses. So very often what I'll have them do is write that letter and burn it, and say some prayers or whatever they need to do, whatever feels comfortable for them as they're letting go of whatever it was that they put into that letter. Very often, there's a need for some ritual of who they were. Say they're beginning to get sick and they can't work anymore. They can't do as much physically. Again, you see this a lot with people with cancer or HIV and AIDS and lots of other illnesses. A sense of who they were, a sense of identity. This is what I do for a living, and now I can. This is the hobbies that I've had, the sports that I have participated in, and now I can't. So if I can't do that anymore, then who am I in the world? And the essence and answer to this question is one all of us need to be asking us, because we are not our jobs. We are not our careers. We are not what we wear, we are not what we eat. We are not who we're in relationship with. We're not our PR and press packet. To me, the whole point of therapy and healing and growth is to be able to get a real handle on who we are. How do we define ourselves as a human being? And that power and that importance exists whether you're out and about in a particular career or whether you're homebound because of an illness. The essence of who you are, the heart that you have, still exists. How are you expressing it? How are you nurturing yourself and others around you? How are you receiving the nurturing of others around you and of whatever spiritual beliefs that you have? So the rituals involved with even letting go of one's ability to function in a certain way and in a certain job is a very important aspect of one's healing into their illness. By accepting that, it's just like what Janice was talking about earlier with her brother-in-law and her sister. You know, we can apply it to that too. When her brother-in-law actually started doing some insight work, I'm assuming this is what happened. He resisted and resisted the surgery. He was probably in a lot of fear of what it might be and what the fear would be of not having the surgery. And a psychiatrist apparently helped him get in touch with some things that allowed him to go ahead with the surgery. Very often what's going on in a situation like that is someone's taking a look at their lives and how they're defined in it and what they're able to do now and what their fear is about what they might not be able to do. But by having the surgery, he was able to start doing more from what I understood from Janice. And sometimes it's our fear that's holding us back from taking the very steps and healing the very wounds that we need to heal. And keeping us in a familiar place of fear and anger and judgment is not the direction that any of us really want to be in. The sense of empowerment that comes with being honest about who you are and what's going on, the sense of empowerment that comes with being able to acknowledge it verbally and publicly, the sense of empowerment that comes with seeing how some of these rituals are actually damaging and destructive, the sense of empowerment that comes by learning new rituals that really embrace who you are, that embrace the heart that's in you and the loving soul that you are, and how you can put that to use. The sense of empowerment that comes from people that I've known who cannot do certain jobs anymore, but their minds and their hearts are still working and have been able to reach out to other people who are suffering by being of service and volunteering the time and energy that they did have to other people maybe going through some of the same stuff they're going through. The sense of empowerment that comes from knowing that as the world as you've known it seems to be getting smaller, you might actually be getting bigger because of the peace you're finding in the moment. And that is probably the most important transformation that can take place as an illness is taking over. The potential for healing from that illness then also increases, because the less you're in the struggle around it, the more you stay in the moment of it, the more at peace you find yourself in dealing with it, the more possibility you have of your body not getting worn out and be able to use its own natural healing abilities to improve your situation. And that's the thought I'm going to leave you with tonight. And I'm glad you listened. I'm glad Janice was listening tonight. I hope her meeting's going well. And I'm here every Tuesday night. And for those of you who are listening outside the Phoenix area, with the change of clocks this Sunday, means that we'll be on at the same time as we're on in Phoenix, which is 7 to 8 p.m. So if you're outside Phoenix in the future, we'll be on from 7 to 8 p.m. I hope you listen in next week, and thanks for listening tonight. This is Stuart Altshuler.